Let's go back in time to 1932 as Converse brings you historic footage of the legendary original Celtics with whom all great professional teams are compared.
We have now taken over your radio.
Richie Guerin is about to show you the most important step in getting past a man. It's the first one.
And Oscar will inbound it. The men in green, the Milwaukee Bucks, that's Al Cinder against Bellamy.
It has Jordan. Allen shakes free. Gets two!
Gilmore on
a big stop! Oh, brother!
Lead Toledo Artis. You get 21.
4:28 to go in the first quarter for the Cal Palace. Here's Barry.
Jordan. Open. Chicago with the lead!
Hello, and welcome to the Over and Back Classic NBA podcast at harborparoxysm.com. I am Jason Mann, and with me as usual is Rich Kraich. Rich, great to be back with you.
Yeah, absolutely. We're done. It's over.
We are. We're finishing up our WrestleMania series, looking back at Bill Russell's career. We've gone through every single playoff series that he ever took part in, and we've gone through a lot of his aspects as a social activist, his influence as a great player, really just about everything that you could possibly get into. I think we've delved into at least to a certain extent. So hopefully people have enjoyed it. I think we've really enjoyed researching it and doing the show. I think this ended up being a much bigger...
I have not, actually, no. You did not? No, I did not. So I'm glad. No, I'm just... Don't assume. I had a
right.
It was horrible. It was an awful, arduous night.
I apologize. All right. Well, that's we'll talk about that off the air.
Okay, good.
But yeah, this ended up, I think, being a much bigger project than we initially expected to be, just because there ended up being so many ways to divide, and just some of the research ended up being so big that it's like, oh, we'll just keep on going and dividing this up and tackling it. But we're finished now. We just kind of had we had a few people ask us questions about different things that we wanted to delve into, so we're going to talk about that and just a few things that were a little bit of stray notes that we had talked about. So I just, you know, we just kind of wanted to kind of slam it in there, so to speak. That's not the best expression I've ever had, but yeah, we're just gonna just share some of our favorite stories and anecdotes and some of our extra notes and see where it goes.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we'll start with James Curdy at James Curdy wanted us to talk a little bit more about Russell's relationship with his teammates. There's some interesting stories from Second Wind and from the other books to go with. So I think we'll just kind of talk about it through the different players. But one of my favorite stories, and we talked a little bit about it, was the idea of Sam Jones sort of being the antagonist for Wilt Chamberlain, of just sort of like he always tried to get in Wilt's head and kind of taunted him and kind of, you know, just like to sort of tease him. And they actually sort of had a friendship off the court as well, but like during the game, he just definitely liked to mess with him. And this kind of made made Russell a little bit upset. Just like, you know, I really didn't like it when Wilt got riled up, because, you know, that made him even more angry, made him even more difficult to deal with. It's like, you know, why do we need to do this? And his quote is, once I made the supreme mistake of asking Sam to lay off, and Sam said, "What's the matter, Russ? You ain't afraid of him, are you?" This got around to the other players, and every chance they got, they'd ask me if I were afraid of Wilt. And then he also talked about Casey always seemed to step on Wilt's feet a few extra times whenever I showed the slightest worry about his mood, and then he and Sam would laugh themselves silly at my distress. So there's a lot of good Celtics just kind of, you know, joking around and keeping things light. And obviously when you're dealing with the intense schedule and the ups and downs of basketball games and having to kind of key yourself up for every game, and being obviously more difficult to do that is as you're as you're spending more time together, it's good to have that kind of that levity, you know, to kind of go along with it as well.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. There's a good there's a good another one that kind of strikes me as far as levity goes is Bob Cousy. Another story from A Second Wind where he talks about Cousy throwing him a pass under the basket near the end of the game, that all that he had to do was dunk the ball, but then he realized that the opposing center was Walter Dukes, who loved to hit him on the head with every shot that he ever took. And then Russell said, well, you were about 10 points ahead with less than a minute to go. And they decided, nope, it's not worth it. So he just simply dribbled the ball from under the basket. And Cousy was out there laughing. He knew when he passed me the ball that I wasn't going to take the dunk. He knew that I'd figure out that we had the game well enough put away that I wouldn't take my beating. He and I laughed so hard that we lost the ball, but not the game. And he thought that Cousy was always kind of doing crazy things when he figured the pressure was off. I thought about another example where he'd bring the ball up the court looking serious and call a non-existent play, yell 22, and turn his back after passing the ball to Sharman, who'd be dumbfounded at what was going on. So so that's kind of a fun one as well as far as the levity goes.
Yeah, it's fun.
Let's see. There's also a good one with Frank Ramsey where and this is, you know, more serious. Like, now he had a close relationship with Ramsey, one of the closest members of the team. But there were and there's one incident where Ramsey really stood up. We talked a little bit about this before where the Celtics were an exhibition game in Lexington in 61. And Russell and the other Celtics black players were refused service at a local coffee shop. So they decided, nope, we're not going to do this. We're going to go home. Russell had previously dealt with similar treatment in an exhibition game. I think it was in Texas at one point, and he had agreed to play. I think it was North Carolina actually, but he agreed to play after discussing it with Auerbach. But this time he basically said, no, we're not going to do it. And Auerbach actually ended up driving them to the airport and, you know, supported them. And some fans and sports writers criticized for not playing and for sullying what should have been Ramsey's night. But then Ramsey said, no, I was 100% behind Russell and the other boys. No thinking man in Kentucky is a segregationist. I can't tell you how sorry I am as a human being, a friend of the players involved, and as a resident of Kentucky for the embarrassment of this incident, which was, of course, you know, good for – kind of showed the you know, the friendship that they developed and the, you know, the kindness that Ramsey showed in that situation where obviously it was a situation that had embarrassed his teammates and that he – even though people take an offense for him, he did not actually take offense for that incident as well. And in fact, support his team. But in 64, there was an SI article that implied that Russell hated white people, which actually his quote was much more complicated than that. But it was taken that way. Surprised that a media that people
shocking,
take
shocking,
something yeah. from a article out of context and blow it up to make it something thing. But basically, Ramsey said, "Hey Russell, I'm white. You hate me." And then Russell said, "Well, Frank, I was misquoted." And then Ramsey let it go. He didn't necessarily believe they'd been misquoted, but I think it kind of showed the. Just the ability for them, you know, that they had this deep friendship that they were able to kind of, you know, obviously you're with people, you're going to occasionally argue with them and deal with these type of things, but they had the level of respect for each other that even when they disagreed or had an issue with each other, they were able to, you know, just let it go and move beyond it. It didn't poison the team, so to speak. So, let's see. There was, let's see. Do you want to talk a little bit about the article about Alcatraz? I thought that one was really interesting.
Yeah,
And that one was. This is from when Russell and Casey Jones and the other San Francisco starting five were in. Of course, being in San Francisco, Alcatraz was in San Francisco, and this is from a great Boston Globe article by. By Baxter Holmes, who's at ESPN now and was a really great I really recommend people Google it and read the whole thing if you hadn't yet, because it's really awesome.
It's fun, yeah. So you have the University of San Francisco, they're starting five. They got a tour of the prison, and of course this isn't like the that's not a big deal. You can go there all the time. Well, no, the prison was still like active when they got the tour of it. So it and of course, as you know, Alcatraz, it was the worst of the worst. It was the absolute, you know, the the criminals of the time in the United States. And of course, they put the rotten apples there because, yeah, they just couldn't go anywhere else. Like, that was the place where, okay, you've gotten out of this jail. This is it. You're here and you're never going to do anything. You know, you're stuck here. It's interesting, though. The convicts, they looked at Russell and they were just in awe, said a few of the guys. Typically, civilians were never allowed beyond the visiting room where they were separated from convicts by a thick thing of glass. They could use a phone to communicate, but the players, they not only walked through the cell house, kitchen, hospital, recreation yard, and the industry, they even ate alongside them and met one who was segregated from all the others, Robert Stroud, the famous Birdman of Alcatraz, a diagnosed psychopath. He was serving a death sentence after killing a prison guard. Yeah, so he was just chilling with the college starting five basketball team, which is very interesting. The day Russell and them strolled through, a memory convicts could savor. Of course, you know, seeing that team and seeing those guys, it was, you know, just a great moment for the convicts. They really just enjoyed it, which, of course, you know, for reasons, this is the article, for reasons no one can quite explain, the visit by the most popular sports team in the area and the most dominant college basketball team in the country stayed hidden, it appears, until a former convict mentioned it halfway through his self-published book, Entombed in Alcatraz, released in 2011. So, yeah, very interesting. It never really got any publicity, and they just kind of did it, and then they left, and that was kind of it. So, just a very interesting moment. But yeah, just crazy that, you know, eating alongside those guys, which, you know, they have nothing to lose, those guys, like, literally nothing to lose, but they didn't care. They did it, and everybody was, seemed to be, as I said, like, they were in awe of Bill Russell, and they enjoyed him. So, that's great. It's a really, really awesome story. Yeah, definitely recommend people check it out if they can.
Yeah. And it was sort of, they talked about how they'd sort of opened up a little bit where they could start listening to the radio and sports games on the radio in San Francisco, being, you know, the, like I said, the best college basketball team of the country and, you know, kind of a source of pride for the area and all that. And then basketball had kind of been, you know, a little bit of an entertainment, allowed to be an entertainment for the game had developed some popularity there. So, yeah, all the aspects of it was really well done piece and really neat to see. So, let's see. There's an anecdote from the rivalry of Russell in his first season, where he was constantly provoked by Ray Felix, who was a Knicks center during a game. So he complained to Auerbach, and Auerbach said, you know, you gotta take the matters in your own hands. So after the next provocation, Russell punched Felix unconscious, paid a $25 fine, and was no longer a target of cheap fouls. So there's similar stories with Wilt when he first got in the league. And it makes sense that, you know, a guy would be physically tested to do that, to see how he didn't like to do it. And I don't think Russell or Wilt particularly liked physical pain. I mean, Wilt didn't, although, you know, for him, it was, probably for each guy, it was a sort of a situation of, you know, I'm so big and strong, I don't want to, you know, hurt anybody else, you know. And there's also certainly a different, you know, when you're a black player playing in a mostly white league, there's certainly, you know, if you get violent in a situation, there's definitely a different connotation to that, where, you know,
you gotta be a little careful. You can't just go throwing fists everywhere else. Yeah, it's not gonna go well for you, unfortunately.
Yes. So, and another one from Russell when he was a rookie, sort of testing his limits as a rookie, where he was frustrated at Bill Sharman and other players who were kind of like taking the ball and shooting it from his spot in the floor at center. And Red was like, or Russell said, yeah, would not get into the huddle. And then Red, you know, basically it's like, why aren't you in the huddle? And he said, you know, I play center. Everyone else is playing center, and I don't need to be in the huddle to know how to get out of their way. And Russell, Red thought about it for a few seconds and said, okay, nobody plays center but Russell. And that was basically the end of that. So, Red and me, we haven't had a chance to talk about it, because I read the book sort of late in this process, and a couple stories here that we're going to mention, but it is kind of a nice look at sort of the way that the friendship developed between Russell and, you know, clearly how much affection he had for Red. And it's a light book, and there's some stories from it that, you know, definitely heard from before, but it's sort of a nice one of you know, it wouldn't be on the top of my list of Russell books to read, but there are some nice anecdotes in it, in the book. So it was worth reading, even though it was a little bit on the thin side, I would say. There's a pretty good story from Second Wind on Russell being approached by a gambler, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, thankfully, to Russell's credit, he was very quick to kind of squash it in a different way. He said, you can't afford it, to the gambler. The gambler was offended, and Russell explained that he would make over $1 million in his career, and they'd have to risk it all, plus his reputation. So it would cost about $9 or $10 million per game. Later, it was reported, Bill Russell then reported that to the commissioner. So he's not wrong. Like it was a future buy there. Where he's like, yeah, you know, you can give me a lot of money right now, or you know, I'll just keep him make a lot of money the rest of my career and then my reputation and stuff. And of course, at that era too, you know, we're still in the era of the NBA being, you know, of gambling being a problem in there and point fixing scandals and guys being, you know, kicked out of the leagues forever and guys like, you know, of course, like a Connie Hawkins or whatever would have to go to other leagues to avoid, you know, punishment or whatever. So yeah, it's just for him to be up there and just kind of say no, I'm good, I'm gonna do this thing instead is just show some great intuition by Russell there to sort of squash it and move on with the rest of his career.
Yeah So there's a for Tommy Heinsohn, he and Bill Russell kind of had a you know, some ups and downs in the relationship. When Russell was a rookie, well, they both were rookies, basically openly said to Heinsohn that he deserved half of his $300 rookie of the year check, which, you know, kind of offended Heinsohn. And, you know, and, you know, if you look at it objectively, you could say you could kind of go either way as far as who should deserve the rookie of the year, because Heinsohn was really productive and he played the whole season where Russell didn't play the whole season. So even though you would obviously say Russell was a better player. But you know they spent a lot of time together as teammates, and Heinsohn had a lot of great things to say about Russell. And they talked a bit later about where in 71 the team assembled in Reading, where Russell lived, to be with him as the town proudly honored their captain. It was the first time Heinsohn ever saw Russell cry. He was so happy. A few months later, some people broke into Russell's home, rampaged, smashed his trophies, defecated in his bed, and spread the excrement over his walls. We've talked a lot about the kind of stuff that he endured like that, unfortunately. They didn't want any black men in their town, but in the locker room, Russell never talked about the terrible things that happened to him so close to the Celtic city, and Heinsohn said he was too proud to let people know. And Cousy said he also felt guilty. I wish I'd done more to support Russ. We were so close as teammates, but we all should have been more aware of his anger. And Cousy draws a deep sigh. But you know, jocks, all into the macho thing. Always afraid to let the conversation be anything more than superficial. We mature so much later than anyone else.
Yeah, that's, he's got it. So.
Yeah. There's some good stuff from when he was when his statue was finally dedicated in 2013.
Yeah. Fired up here real quick. Of course he got the statue, and it this is an article from SB Nation as well that kind of details it a little bit. If you look up Bill Russell statue, SB Nation, you should be able to find it pretty good. But here's some quotes from it. It was the rest of Russell's life that made him so compelling. I consider the eclectic list of people who were present for his long-awaited statue unveiling at Boston City Hall on Friday. The NBA was represented by several Hall of Famers, including Charles Barkley, Bill Walton, and Clyde Drexler. He had ex-Celtics like Sam Jones and JoJo White, Commissioner David Stern, and also his deputy, Adam Silver. But the basketball guys weren't really the important part. I think what was most important here was, you know, that you had the Boston Mayor, Tom Mineo, had been there, Governor Deval Patrick, actress Alfre Woodard gave a moving speech about civil rights. Bill Withers was there. Johnny Mathis was there. They both performed a song. Bill had just lived such a gigantic life away from just, you know, basketball and competition and all that. And, you know, he had always fought that fight as well and insisted that, you know, people understand that he lived a life beyond, you know, basketball, that I lived a very cultured, a very, you know, culture might be the right, I don't know, just a very diverse life outside of basketball.
Yeah.
And despite the fact that he's only known in large part because of his basketball career, always sort of bothered him a little bit. And he always tried to get away from that. And that's why you saw in his post-playing career, you know, while he coached at places and did some stuff and some GM work or whatever, he always seemed hesitant to say, you know, hey, no, I'm doing this. I'm living a life outside of basketball. So focus on that a little bit, or here's what I'm doing a little bit. So he was always cognizant of that, of trying to get people to know that he lived a gigantic, fruitful life outside of the game. And he wasn't just confined to basketball. That, you know, that wasn't just his life.
Yeah, and a lot of the ceremonial stuff that he sort of, you know, was willing to do later in his life that he wasn't willing to do in the 70s and stuff, like you getting his number re-retired and the statue and things like that, were also to promote, like, mentorship, you know, which has kind of been the cause of his for later in his life of, the, you know, the of programs to, you know, put young people together with mentors and things like that. So he's, you know, even though he's accepting the stuff that he kind of rejected when he was younger, he's doing it, you know, for a greater purpose as well. So. I like, there's a talk of, there's a story toward the end of it where, at the unveiling of the, at the official unveiling, a man yelled, "We love you, Bill." And another added, "Long overdue." And it sort of goes back to the famous Cousy retirement where, you know, the guy screams, "You know, we love you, Cous," and sort of like, you know, kind of a reflection of that. And just shows, like, obviously Russell had a mixed relationship with Boston for a number of times, but there's been some, but now there's more of that in, you know, there's a, you know, there's kind of more of a deeper acceptance of, you know, relationship between them. And he's sort of willing to accept the love that a lot of people in Boston, you know, now feel for him. So a few other things, a few random things that I, want to talk about were, I liked Russell talking about how, especially as he got older, he never ran out of the huddle to the jump circle. He would take his time and walk out slowly with his arms folded in front of him. His quote is, "I'd look at everybody disdainfully like a sleepy dragon who can't be bothered to scare off another would-be hero." And speaking of the mixed reaction with in Boston, after the Celtics lost in 67, the fans in Boston hooted me that summer in the streets. "All washed up, eh? I knew it couldn't last. You guys don't have it anymore. Never had I felt happier that long ago I trained myself to discount the cheers." Jeez. and the booze. Yeah. So,
and then 80-year-old Bostonians that are listening to this show, you guys are kind of mean to Bill.
Yeah. Don't do that. And then he talks about his final season as player coach during the huddle, trying to rally the team. And then he's suddenly in a game against Baltimore, and he starts bursting out laughing uncontrollably. And he says, "Here I am, a grown man, 35 years old, running around semi-nude in front of thousands of people in Baltimore, playing a game and yelling about killing people." And the team, of course, is befuddled by this and not understanding why he's laughing and why he's saying this. And then he said, "That game confirmed my decision to retire. You can't give out what a game requires if you start focusing on its ridiculous aspects." So, also, from a great piece from Frank DeFord, written, I think, in 1999, which was kind of like one of the first, like, big pieces that started Russell sort of kind of publicly coming out of the woodwork and, you know, starting to accept more acclaim and writing Russell Rules and starting to get more of a public persona after having been private for so long. And this piece actually ended up winning, you know, like a several awards that year. But there are a couple of interesting things about it. One was that, you know, we've of course talked about the fact that Russell wouldn't give out autographs, and right. He even didn't want to give his teammates autographs. And, you know, like, one, like Satch Sanders asked, he wanted a signature of every Celtic he played with. And then Russell said, "You, Satch, of all people, know how I feel." Russell snapped. And then, Satch said, "Damn it, I'm your teammate, Russ." Nevertheless, when the shouting was over, Russell still wouldn't sign. So it was
like, he's not going to sell it. He just,
it's a little, maybe a little strong there for Bill, but he obviously has convictions. And, so Russell also talked about this was sort of a playing thing with Cousy and Heinsohn. And the Cousy and Heinsohn things I talked about before were actually from this article as well, talking about kind of supporting Russell when he was dealing with all the things he was dealing with. One of the hardest things he had to accept was that if he filled one lane on a fast break and Heinsohn was on the other flank, Cousy would give Heinsohn the ball and the basket every time. He simply had so much confidence in Heine, Russell says. So I just disciplined myself to run that break all out, even if I knew I wasn't going to get the ball.
Which is a great tidbit, because, yeah, if you loaf on that, then that play's not what it is. Yeah, it's like...
Exactly, yeah. So even though he didn't get the ball there, he still had to, you know, fill that role. And he talked about how... there's a quote from Red and Me about... trying to find that specific... Oh, yeah, he... he encouraged Red encouraged Russell to shoot to keep him more engaged in the game, even though shooting was a weakness. And this was during, you know, his early in his career, his rookie year. And he said Red engineered the system such that all five guys had something integral to do on every play. So, you know, even if you weren't getting the necessary the ball, what you did, you know, mattered on each play. So you being a key thing to keep guys engaged, which I think is it makes total sense when you think about it, but isn't something that you, because obviously there's so much going on in a play in basketball where it's hard, you know, just even people who are experts to keep focus on every single little thing. But the importance, I think, of making sure that everyone knows what they're doing matters and that they need to go, you know, to do it, you know, effectively, I think is really a key part of why the Celtics were such a, you know, great team for so long.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And one thing is that what I hadn't realized is that Jackie Robinson's wife actually asked Bill Russell to be a pallbearer at his funeral. He died in 1973 or 74, I believe. And then Russell said, "Of course I will." And then he asked why, and she said that Russell was Jackie's favorite athlete. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's got to be humbling, you know.
Yeah,
absolutely. Even for a guy like Bill Russell to be like, "Oh, okay,
right." Yeah. So let's see. I think that might be it. I don't know if there's anything else that you have that you wanted to bring up that was. Oh, one more thing. John Havlicek, his first encounter with Russell was during training camp in 62. Russell was struck by Havlicek's work ethic, and Havlicek was taken aback by the big man's generous spirit. When Havlicek mentioned he was in the market for a new stereo, Russell took him all over Boston to find the right piece of equipment. So,
what a guy.
Havlicek wrote in his book, Havlicek's book's not really all that insightful, to be honest, but it's a little, Havlicek was a great player, but maybe not that introspective of a guy. But he, some of his, the culture shock things that he had from coming from Ohio to play in Boston and learning to, you know, play with Russell and play with the other guys, and then later, you know, to take on a bigger role in the 70s. There's a few interesting things there, but there's also one other Havlicek related thing is that he remembered the day that Russell he put the present basketball world perspective. This is from an NBA.com profile of Russell. It was one of those Las Vegas Liberty Golf tournaments, Havlicek said. The Bulls had just won another championship, and someone walked up to Russell and said, "What do you think of the Bulls winning three in a row?" Russell looked at him and said, "Not much." So
take that.
There you go.
Michael.
Yes.
Why don't you win eight?
Yeah, why don't you win eight in a row? Yeah, yeah, there you go. I think that's it, unless you have anything else to discuss.
No, that's it. That's it for the WrestleMania series. No, it's been, like you said, it kind of grew beyond what we maybe even thought it was going to grow to, but I've really enjoyed it, and I think people have enjoyed it as well, and that's the important part, is I think we've had a lot of people discussing it, a lot of people mentioning different tidbits, people sending us stuff, so that's always encouraging when, you know, we sort of have this harebrained idea or whatever, and we're like, you know, no one's going to care, but a lot of people cared, and a lot of people listened, and a lot of people have supported us throughout this entire series, so it's been great, and we're gearing up for our summer series as well, which I think is going to gain a lot of steam as well. I think people are going to be way into it, and I can't wait to get it started, but this was great as well.
Yeah. It's been really fun, and I appreciate people who have dug it, and if you haven't been into it, hopefully you'll like what we have next. It's we're going to be looking at the basketball mysteries of the 70s. We're going to dig into the NBA and the ABA of that time period, and which I think is, we've talked about it a little bit before, but I think there is, that decade is such, I think it has more mysteries than any other decade in NBA history, because it's harder to wrap your mind around, like, the biggest stories of the 70s are not nearly as clear as, like, the biggest stories of the, you know, the 80s are obviously right. Celtics and Lakers, and, you know, the Lakers are the dominant team there, and the battles they had against, you know, the Sixers and the Celtics and the Pistons, of course. And then, you know, the 90s are, you know, central, Jordan and the Bulls are the central thing. And then, you know, even the 2000s are the Lakers and the Spurs. And, you know, those, I think there's like a dynasty for each decade. There's a team or two for each decade where you can kind of center your thinking around. There are standout players who are obviously the players of the decade. And the 70s, it's a little bit harder because the universe of basketball expanded to so much, so many teams, so many leagues, so many movement between teams and leagues. There wasn't that same kind of stability that led to dynasties. A lot of teams, it looked like they were going to become dynasties, broke up early or something happened. So there's also, you know, there's more footage of the 70s and there's the 60s, but not that much more. And the league is so much bigger. I think it's just harder to get your like mind wrapped around all the different things. So I think there's going to be a lot of just we're going to try to look at as many different things as we can, sort of figure out, you know, questions that we have and try to figure out their solutions. We're also going to we've picked 15 different teams that we would argue have a case for being the team of the decade, whether it's basketball accomplishments or being interesting or, you know, or different aspects. We're going to spend a lot of time looking at all those different teams and figuring out who was important and telling stories and good stuff like that. So we're excited to do it.
Absolutely. Can't wait.
All right. Well, thanks, everyone, for checking us out. You can find us at hardwareparoxysm.com. You can also find us on iTunes and Stitcher. If you left us a rating and review, we would adore you, and we would sing your praises for a long time.
Roses at your feet.
Yes. Well, you know, yeah. So, and
e-feet. We're not going to go and meet you wherever you are.
Virtual feet. Yeah.
Well, unless you're nearby. If you're very close to me, maybe I will. But maybe not roses, but
all right.
We'll talk about it.
We'll think something.
DM us. We'll talk.
Right. Yeah. And also you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at Over and Back NBA. So, thanks for listening, and we'll be back again soon.